I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for this NPR station podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Wayne, welcome to Radio Times. Last week, a Shiite militia group that took control of the Iraqi city of Amara was seen patrolling the streets with rocket-propelled grenade launchers and AK-47s. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez just announced that his country was going to open a factory to build AK-47s. A human rights lawyer in Nigeria was interviewed about recent fighting and kidnapping in his country. He said, quote, "There's no rule of law here. The AK-47 rules." AK-47 stands for Automatic Kalashnikov. It was invented by a Soviet soldier named Mikhail Kalashnikov almost 60 years ago. Since then, it has become a popular and deadly weapon used around the world. My guest, Larry Kahaner, has written a book about the development and history of this assault rifle. It's called AK-47, The Weapon That Changed the Face of War. He says it changed the balance of power in warfare and law enforcement because it's so easy to use, so cheap, so durable, and it hardly ever jams. Larry Kahaner was a Washington correspondent for Business Week magazine. He covered the Infantry Training Center at Fort Benning for Knight Ridder Newspapers, and he's the author of 8 other books. He joins us by telephone. Larry Kahaner, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Good morning, Marty. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm terrific.
I wonder if you could give our audience what makes this AK-47 such a unique assault rifle. What are the unique features for this weapon?
Well, the unique feature is that it's so simple that it hardly ever breaks. And it's sort of counterintuitive because we always think that the more complex things are, the better they perform, and the more sophisticated they are, that they're going to work better. But this is so simple. It's almost like a pencil. You know, you can't improve on the pencil. It's kind of like that.
And what got you interested in this whole story of the AK-47? And I do want to talk about it, but I'm curious if there was something in particular that got you interested in investigating this assault rifle.
Well, really, there were two things. The first thing was that when I covered Fort Benning, which is the infantry center in Columbus, Georgia, for the newspaper there, the Columbus Ledger, I was covering Fort Benning. I used to travel around with the general, the commander of the post. And we used to go out, and this was in the early 1980s, mid-1980s, and the U.S. Army was just getting into some of the high-tech stuff. They were putting computer chips into weapons and so forth. And the general turned to me, and he said, you know, no matter how sophisticated and how complex our weapons get, or the Soviet Union, that sort of dates it.
Indeed.
He said to me, what really matters is trying to get that one guy off his piece of land, off his real estate, and he's going to be carrying an AK-47. And I've sort of never forgotten that. Now, fast forward to about the past 2 years, and all of us, including you, Marty, I'm sure, you see on the newspapers, you see on the blogs, you see on the web, you see on television, magazines, this weapon. And then all the insurgents, all the bad guys, if you will, are carrying this weapon. It's the signature iconic rifle with the sort of banana-shaped clip, and we all know what it looks like.
Well, let's go back to the invention of the AK-47, and we meet Mikhail Kalashnikov. He was a Soviet soldier, actually sustained injuries in World War II. What inspired him to develop this assault rifle?
Well, at the time, the Germans had just invented a new way of war, and it was called Blitzkrieg, as opposed to World War I, where people just went into their bunkers and just sort of hunkered down and sniped at each other. Blitzkrieg meant that you sort of ran very quickly through the lines, you used a lot of vehicles, and you broke through lines, and they invented this, what they called a machine pistol in English, and it is basically a submachine gun. That's what we call it today. And it allowed them to kill lots of people very quickly, including Russian prisoners. And the Russians had nothing like this, and so Kalashnikov wanted to even the playing field and invent for Russia, for the Soviet Union at the time, a comparable weapon. He tried to do that, and it didn't work, and he came up with a different idea, which was the assault rifle.
And this was, he was a lowly soldier. He wasn't a commander or general or anything like that.
No, he was a sergeant of a tank.
But I guess what he took was the sort of best of the technology of the day?
Exactly right. He even took stuff from the U.S. M1, which is a famous rifle we all see in the World War II movies. He took from some German rifles, and he took bits and pieces from here and there. Now, because he was not a professional gun maker, he didn't have the ego that said, I've got to reinvent the wheel. And so he said, you know what, I'm just going to take the best of the best and make it really simple. And again, because he was not an engineer, he went towards the simple and the less complex as opposed to making something more complex and more sophisticated.
And the goal was to, what, protect Mother Russia from Nazis or any enemy willing to attack his country?
That was his only goal. It was to try to get something that would beat the Nazis. Unfortunately for him, the World War II ended too soon.
And 47 stands for 1947.
Absolutely. AK stands for Automatic Kalashnikov, 1947, the year that it was first produced.
And when did the, that would be Soviet government, when did they begin to use the AK-47?
Well, the interesting thing is that U.S. military intelligence knew about this thing because after we won the war, the U.S. went in there and looked at it and sort of dismissed it as a piece of junk and, you know, it's not even important. And the world did not see it until the Hungarian Revolution in 1956, 7-8 years later, and where it shows up in public, and all of a sudden it's killing tens of thousands of Hungarian protesters.
And we should add that this week is the 50th anniversary of the beginning of the Hungarian uprising.
Absolutely, and what happened was the Soviet tanks couldn't get through some of the smaller streets, and so the soldiers got out and literally just mowed down all the protesters.
And that's when this gun, this assault rifle, got what, national, international attention, American attention?
Actually, even then, the U.S. Dismissed it. It sounds kind of funny, but even then, the U.S. dismissed it. The U.S. was still using the M1 rifle, which is a single-shot, you know, incredible weapon for its time, but so far behind the curve. And again, it was still dismissed, and not until almost the Vietnam era, even the Korea, the U.S. is still using the M1, and not until the Vietnam War did the U.S. decide to change to a new rifle.
And as you describe it, it wasn't an imperfect rifle in that there were accuracy problems with the AK-47.
You know, actually, I'm not a gun person per se, and people sort of hate when I say this, but actually it is a piece of junk. I mean, that's what I call it. It is a piece of junk. It's poorly made in most cases. You know, it's flimsy. I mean, you fire this thing and it feels like it's going to just rattle to pieces, but yet you can't argue with the fact that there are over 100 million of them in the world.
And I'm assuming you fired an AK-47, so you know what it feels like?
I know exactly what it feels like. I've fired several different kinds of them. I've also fired M16 rifles, several other rifles as well, and compared them.
Well, you know, we actually got off the internet some sounds of first an AK-47, then an M16, just so our listeners can hear what these two assault rifles sound like. And we'll begin with the AK-47. And I wonder, Larry, if you could even just sort of describe to our listeners what, I know you haven't heard it, but I know you know what an AK-47 sounds like, what we should listen for, and then we'll talk about it.
Sure. One of the things, I'm not sure which tape you have, but you should listen for the pattern of it. Generally, there is a three-burst pattern, unless it's a fully automatic, and then you'll just keep going. As long as you press the trigger, the bullets will still come out. Let's hear it first, and then maybe I'll describe it afterwards.
Fair enough. And this is the sound of an AK-47. What do you hear, Larry?
It is just a very simple, basic signature, as the term is. Now, if you play the M16, you'll hear something very different.
Well, let's listen, and this is the M16 by way of comparison. You want to speak to that, Larry?
Well, you can hear sort of a higher pitch. Now, what's really important is not so much of that they sound, you know, one way or another, but they sound differently. And in fact, during the Vietnam War, a lot of the U.S. soldiers, and we can talk about this later, the M16 did not work when it first came out during the Vietnam War. It was a mess, and it kept jamming. And the soldiers used to take the AK-47s off the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese and use them instead of their M16 rifles. Now, here's the problem. When you're in a jungle and you hear an AK-47 go off, you shoot in that direction if you're a U.S. soldier. And very often, the U.S. soldiers using AKs were shot by their friendly fire, as it's called. And so AK-47s were banned by the U.S. Army for soldiers to use, but they still used them because they liked them so much.
And you said that, and I'm interested in the Vietnam War, because you say, I guess this is the first time American soldiers had to confront the AK-47, and literally they thought it was a better gun with all its problems than the M-16?
Absolutely, and I'll tell you why. The M-16, well, we can talk about that. That's a whole other story, and how that Army corruption and greed literally made the M-16 jam, and that's a horrible story. But what happened was, again, the Vietnam War brought along a different kind of battle, and you know, you had Blitzkrieg and trench warfare. Now we've got something different, and what it is you have patrols of 10 to 20 men going past each other in the jungle, and they can't even see each other because the jungle is so thick. Well, all of a sudden, someone hears the other side make a noise, and what you do is you just fire as fast as you can into that direction of the, you know, of the branch or the leaf or whatever you hear. And in that sort of warfare, the AK-47 does what's called spray and pray. You just put as many bullets out as you can in the direction of what you think the enemy is and hope for the best. And in that kind of warfare, the AK-47 won hands down. As you had said before, it is not a very accurate weapon. It's not the type you want if you've got time to shoot like a sniper. But to just spray as many bullets as you can in the direction of the enemy, that's what you want.
So do you think the AK-47 is then, what, better suited for guerrilla warfare?
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. And in fact, right now in Iraq, the big problem with the M-16, which is actually now an M-4, sort of a carbine version, which actually is a little bit better, it still is very prone to sand from sandstorms and dust and dirt. And U.S. soldiers have to put things in their barrels. Sometimes they put condoms over the barrels to keep the dust out, and you have to clean it every single day, sometimes twice a day. The AK-47, literally, you don't have to clean. You can drag it through the mud. You can put it underwater. You can bury it for a year, literally, and there have been cases of this. Take the thing out, kick it, and it'll start.
We interviewed a Pentagon correspondent last week about Iraq, and he said that many Iraqi civilians in that country have an AK-47 in their homes.
Yep. In fact, the law is that every family is allowed to have one weapon. Many have more than that, but you're allowed to have one, and they always choose an AK-47.
And is it for all the reasons that we've been talking about? Or is it just the sheer availability in Iraq today?
It's all of those things. It's cheap. It's easy to use. You don't have to take care of it. Because the tolerances are so large, it'll take bullets that aren't very good, that are secondhand bullets that have been sitting around. It's perfect for the guerrilla. And the other thing is that you don't have to be very good at it. And M16 is a terrific rifle because it's very accurate. You know, you put something in your sights and you're going to hit it. With the AK-47, you put something in the sights, you may not hit it, but you can certainly spray a lot of bullets in that direction.
And that's Larry Kahaner, our guest today on Radio Times, and we're talking about his new book. It's called the AK-47, The Weapon That Changed the Face of War. Lines open with questions, comments, 1-888-477-9499. More about this weapon. We'll be right back.
PhillyFunGuide.com supports WHYY with a complete listing of events like Eastern State Penitentiary, a National Historic Landmark. Eastern State Penitentiary offers daytime history tours and its nighttime Halloween tour, Terror Behind the Walls. Information at easternstate.org and 215-236-3300. The penitentiary is located just 5 blocks from the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Eastern State Penitentiary tours and more are featured on PhillyFunGuide.com.
Hi, I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks so much for making a pledge of support to 91FM during our fall membership campaign. You answered our call, and we appreciate it. Now we'll take your money and put it together with the money from thousands of listeners who also made a pledge and invest it in the programs that you rely on here on 91FM, whether it's Radio Times, Fresh Air, All Things Considered, Morning Edition, Voices in the Family. So from all of us here at WHYY, thanks a lot.
How do families affected by cancer go about their lives? How does illness, treatment, and the threat of death change their everyday routines and love for each other? Join us for the next Voices in the Family when Dan Gottlieb's guest is Eric Kingsen. Kingsen describes his wife's battle with cancer in his new book, Lessons from Joan. This book also offers guidance and support for families fighting illness. Today at noon on WHYY 91 FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about the history of the AK-47 with Larry Kahaner, author of a book called AK-47, The Weapon That Changed the Face of War. He's a former Washington correspondent for Businessweek magazine. He covered the Infantry Training Center at Fort Benning for Knight Ridder newspapers, and he's also the author of a number of other books as well. Lines open for any questions or comments that you might have about this assault rifle. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I want to pick up and talk a little bit more about the use of the AK-47 in Iraq today. My understanding, I believe from your book, Larry, is that the Iraqi military really requested the AK-47 for its soldiers.
Yeah, not only did they request it, but when the Department of Defense, U.S. Department of Defense, offered to give them M16 rifles, they downright refused them. They don't like them. They say that all their people are more familiar with the AK. Now, imagine that. They're just sort of, you know, growing up in this country where they're all familiar with a certain rifle, and that's what they wanted. So the United States military had to go to Jordan and buy the AK-47s from Jordan, which actually were made in Germany.
Does that, though, indicate that, the U.S. military is changing its view of the AK-47?
Well, very interesting it is, and it's sort of a jingoistic kind of thing. You know, I don't know if you remember, several weeks ago, Time magazine had a cover where it had the M16 intertwined with an AK-47, sort of east versus west kind of thing. And that's very indicative, and so the U.S. Army could never really go to an AK-47 because that's, you know, again, the anti-Western icon. But other countries, of course, can and do. The several things are happening, however. There are a lot of stories, and you see this on the military blogs, of soldiers in Iraq, U.S. soldiers, picking up AK-47s and using them because you don't have the problem of the jungle and noise. I mean, everybody knows where everybody is when you have a firefight. But the other part of it is that U.S. soldiers are now, and have been for a while now, trained on the AK-47 in case they find it and need to use it in an emergency.
Well, let me loop back and talk a little bit about another interesting history of this weapon, and this is the Afghan War against the USSR. Soviet soldiers moved into Afghanistan. I'm assuming they were armed in part with AK-47s?
Yep, that's exactly right. The Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan in 1979 in what they call their Vietnam. Lasted for about 10 years. And when the Soviet Union came in, they had their AK-47s, and the Mujahideen had some very old weapons from all around the world, kind of just a mishmash of things. The U.S. CIA, of course, as we know now, gave them and sold them, delivered to them, millions and millions of AK-47s. Why AK-47s? Well, it's sort of a plausible deniability thing also, because they're cheap, easy to get in the Middle East, and that's what you use. That's what people use around the world. And so what's ironic about this, of course, is that the Mujahideen did, in fact, drive the Soviet Union out using guerrilla tactics revolving around the AK-47. And those AK-47s, in fact, are still there, filtered down. And Osama bin Laden uses them. All of al-Qaeda uses them. And some of the AK-47s that the U.S. soldiers now see in Afghanistan were actually given to the enemy by, not the Mujahideen, but the enemy, the Taliban, for example, by the CIA. So isn't that something, huh?
Well, and you also write that in 2002, the first U.S. soldier killed by an AK-47 was being used by a 14-year-old?
Yep, that's sad on so many different levels. Because the AK-47 is so cheap and easy to use and doesn't require any maintenance, you, for the first time in history, can have large numbers of child soldiers. Mm. And we saw that in Africa, and we see it in South America. And that, to me, is one of the saddest legacies of the AK.
And I do want to talk about that. But just to finish this chapter about Afghanistan, because you also describe the amount of weapons that were brought into this region, in part by the CIA, and something like 400,000 AK-47s?
We don't even know the number. Some people say it's in the millions. Reports say it's 400,000. I went conservative on this and said 400,000.
You describe that the evolution then of a Kalashnikov culture.
Yeah, in fact, they started to call it that because everyone had an AK. I mean, everybody in the whole Middle East had an AK-47, and it grew up like a culture. And not only did you have people using these for weapons, but you had them as livelihoods. And even now in Iraq and Afghanistan, you find families, you know, mom and pop kind of businesses are revolving around the AK-47, sort of like in the United States we have a culture revolving around the automobile. And some of the people there make their own Kalashnikovs, their own AK-47s. It's, you know, a custom-made kind of thing. And they fix them. And you can take an AK-47 to some guy in a bazaar, and, you know, he hits it literally with a hammer and a rock and, you know, uses a forge, and he can fix this thing and give it back to you.
Kind of like currency in a way.
Pardon me?
Like currency in a way? I mean, sort of buying and selling, bartering, trading an AK-47?
It is. In fact, that's a very good point, which I'm glad you brought up, because in Africa we actually do have a currency of AK-47s for cattle. AK-47s equal a certain number of cattle, which are traded, depending upon what's going on. And in South America, we have reports of AK-47s being traded for cocaine. And there is, again, a barter system that's used because this weapon is so much part of daily life. In fact, in Africa, they call it the African credit card because you don't leave home without it.
And you figure there are, what, 100 million Kalashnikov AK-47s in the world today?
Yeah, we don't really know the exact number because so many of these are made in countries that don't keep records, like China. China actually is the largest maker of AK-47s. They have an old a version of their own. And we don't really know, but we think it's around 75 to 100 million. And the other aspect of it is that these weapons can last for literally decades. I mean, the United Nations finds 50-year-old Kalashnikovs still being used.
And is this the same design that Mikhail Kalashnikov came up with 60 years ago?
It is the same basic design. Now you use plastic for some of what they call the furniture, you know, the butts, the stock, and so forth. But basically, it's the same thing. And, you know, there'll be milled versus stamped. But, yeah, basically, it's the same thing.
Mikhail Kalashnikov is still alive. He's in his 80s. What does he think of his invention?
Well, he is sort of very schizophrenic about it, as you might imagine. On the one hand, he's very proud that he invented something that is iconic, that has lasted and, you know, withstood this test of time. On the other hand, he is very sad that it is used by terrorists in his own country now. The Chechen rebels, of course, use the AK-47 against the Russian government. But, you know, what he's doing now, he's in his 80s and he's really kind of feeble and he's almost deaf from firing his AK so much. But his big thing is now selling vodka. He's branded a vodka with the AK-47.
And did he ever make any money off the assault rifle, the AK-47?
He made zero. No money at all. And it's always sort of bugged him. He'll say it in private, not so much in public. But the man who invented the M16, Eugene Stoner, got about $1 per weapon and had his own jet and all that kind of stuff. And up until recently, Kalashnikov was living in government-subsidized housing and getting like a pension of like $100 a month.
He's quoted as saying, "I wish I had invented a lawnmower." Was he being serious about that?
He was being serious. It depends on how you catch him. Some days he will defend his weapon as the best thing and the most important thing in the world, and other days I think he just gets very sad and melancholy about it.
And does anyone know what kind of lawnmower he had in mind?
Yes, in fact, you can see a picture of it, believe it or not. And there was a museum dedicated to him in his hometown, and it looks kind of like a almost like a weed whacker. It's got like funky kind of wheels on it. It's a contraption.
Maybe more complicated than the AK-47, or who knows, I guess, at this point.
probably about the same number of moving parts.
And that's Larry Kahaner, our guest today on Radio Times. And we invited him to join us today on the program to talk about the assault rifle known as the AK-47. And that's the title of his new book. It's subtitled The Weapon That Changed the Face of War. And if you have been following wars across the, around the world, then it's clear it's one of the most popular weapons out there. And Larry Kahaner is a former Washington correspondent for Business Week magazine. And just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I do want to talk more about this history, and especially the use of child soldiers and AK-47s, but let's get a couple of callers in our conversation. We've got Bill from Booth Wynn. Bill, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello, Mike.
Hi there.
Yes, I wanted to ask your guest, or if you would ask your guest, if he knew about a gentleman, I believe his name was Carbine Williams. There was a movie made way back when starring Jimmy Stewart about the guy who invented the M1 carbine, which might be considered by some to be the first assault rifle. It was used by the Marines in the Pacific in World War II, and it was a short-barreled version of the M1 Garand, I believe. And I was just wondering if Kalashnikov ever heard of him or if he had ever seen one of his M1 carbines. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
No, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Can you speak about that a bit, Larry Kahaner?
Sure. For those who don't know what a carbine is, it basically is a shortened rifle, and they shorten the barrel, so it's first used by horse soldiers, and now, of course, it's used by soldiers, you know, having to get in and out of Humvees and tanks and paratroopers because it's shorter. And the version that the U.S. soldiers now use in Iraq is an M4 carbine, which is actually a carbine version of the M16, and I'm sure, to answer your question, that Kalashnikov knew about it. He read all about these things. He knew a lot about all of the kinds of weapons.
Bill, thanks for the call. Let's get Dave from Quakertown to join us. Hi, Dave. Go ahead. Your Radio Times.
Yeah, I was just wanted to comment on the difference in the caliber and the bullets between the M16 and the AK-47, the M16 being a 223 caliber, which is a lighter, faster bullet, which is really designed to wound, not to kill, even though it does kill. And the 30 caliber AK bullet's a slower bullet, heavier bullet, and has a propensity probably to kill more than the wound. I guess that's what you heard, the difference in the cycling rate on that. So I think that's one of the big differences in urban combat, that the 30 caliber bullet's probably a little more effective.
Yeah, Dave, let me get to Larry to respond to your observations in terms of, the wound factor between these various rifles.
Yeah, he's absolutely right, and this is a controversy that looms large amongst ballistics engineers and amongst soldiers themselves. It sounds counterintuitive, but the M16 bullet is actually very, very small, I mean by weight. But the idea is you propel it with a large amount of powder, and so you have high velocity and a very small bullet. And when it goes into the human body, you have something called hydrostatic shock. And literally, it goes into the human body and literally destroys the organs. The problem with it in combat is that it won't go through like wood. It won't go through stucco, that kind of thing. Now you take the AK-47 bullet, which is much larger, even though it shoots at a slower velocity, it will go through like fences and leaves and bushes. Mm. I mean, I've heard stories from guys in Vietnam who literally would take an AK-47 off an enemy and use it like a hatchet or like a chainsaw and knock down a tree so they could get to the enemy. You can't do that with an M16.
Dave, thanks for the call. You describe, Larry, the AK-47 as a true weapon of mass destruction.
Absolutely. It kills. We know that in the world, small arms, and not including landmines, kill about 500,000 people a year, sometimes more, sometimes less. And the AK-47 kills about half of those, so it's about 250,000 people a year, believe it or not. Mm. And it's a large, large number. And I call it that because it's really killed more people than the atomic bomb.
When you add up almost 60 years of its use.
Well, yeah, I'm not talking yearly now. We know that small arms kill about 1,000 people a day around the world, and it's much. And that doesn't count some of the what I count as the side numbers and the indirect. For example, in Darfur, you have people dying of starvation because supplies cannot get to them because the militia are preventing help coming, and they were using AK-47s.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Africa and the AK-47. You describe Charles Taylor when he overthrew the government in Liberia. He had a small group of soldiers. They took over the country, and they used AK-47s.
Yeah, Charles Taylor in Liberia is actually, I call him the poster boy of the AK-47 change and how the and how it's changed the face of warfare. Because here we have a man with 100 guys, all of them carrying AK-47s, and they were able to take over the capital and displace the government with just 100 guys. And they kept power. As you know, it's a horrible, horrible story. They kept power by going around the countryside and handing out AK-47s to anybody who could join them. And this included boys and even girls, teenagers, and, you know, as low as young as 9 years old. And in return for their allegiance, they were allowed to pillage anybody in any city and town that they wanted to do it. And so in that way, he literally took over an entire country, literally with just AK-47.
Mm. And for a child, and you have pictures in your book of children holding AK-47s, and it's you know, when you see news accounts from time to time, you'll see children holding an AK-47. It's a gun that a kid can use?
Absolutely. It's heavy. It's you know, weighs 8-9 pounds, mm-hmm. and you see some of these kids straining from it, but it doesn't matter because literally you can throw that kid out there and say, just fire. And the kid can just fire, and you know he's going to hit something.
So when we see or even hear about child soldiers, chances are they're carrying an AK-47?
100% of the time.
100% of the time.
Absolutely. Because M16s are too expensive. They won't be given to a child who unfortunately, are considered expendable.
You have a scene in here, actually it was in Sierra, I think it was in Sierra Leone, a Irish regiment that literally came up against children carrying AK-47s. And, you know, do you shoot a child with an AK-47?
Yeah, this was a very famous case. It was called Operation Barabbas. And literally some British soldiers went into Sierra Leone as sort of a peacekeeping move. And they were up against child soldiers. Now, as far as we know, this is the first blatant case of Western soldiers up against child soldiers, and they didn't have the heart to shoot the kids. They just didn't, no matter how deadly a force it was. And as a result, they were taken prisoners, and the British Special Forces had to come in and get them. But again, this is another watershed time where what do you do? I mean, what's the doctrine? What do you tell a Western soldier about a child soldier who's got an AK-47 in hand? It's a very difficult situation.
Well, and also, we're about a minute away from our second break, but also in terms of warfare, you have sophisticated, you know, weaponry used by developed countries, and there they are facing down a kid with an AK-47.
Exactly, and it's exactly what the commandant of Fort Benning told me years ago. It's you got to get that one person off his piece of real estate, and guerrilla war is like in Iraq now, which is literally a guerrilla war. It's one person at a time, one inch at a time, and that's the sad part of it.
And is that how you think then the AK-47 is changing warfare?
Absolutely. It's changing it in several ways. One is that it allows child soldiers, so you have a huge group of a pool of soldiers that are available to you. Secondly, it can take anybody, no matter how unsophisticated and how untrained, and they can be a formidable soldier or a warrior. And the last is that because the weapons are so cheap and so ubiquitous, in fact, we can talk about lords of war, that these small conflicts just go on and on and on and on and on.
And that's Larry Kahaner, our guest today on Radio Times, and we're talking about his new book. It's called AK-47, The Weapon That Changed the Face of War. We'll talk more after this short break and also take some more phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm Steve Madva, chairman of the Opera Company of Philadelphia, and I invite you to give opera a try. It's an art form unlike any other. Music that sparkles, young voices, high laughter and higher drama, and English translations above the stage. I encourage you to experience Rossini's Cinderella at the Academy of Music, November 8th through 19th. For details, 215-893-1018 or operaphilly.com. The Opera Company proudly supports WHYY.
One, two, three, My baby don't matter. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Andre Benjamin, a.k.a. Andre 3000, of the hip-hop duo Outkast. He has a new animated series called Class of 3000 on the Cartoon Network. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
Next time on Day to Day.
Terry Gumbert is pimping his ride.
One looks like the bling bling wheel, if you will. It's chrome, shiny, almost looks like it's spinning inside the wheel.
But Terry's flashy new accessory isn't for his car. It's for his wheelchair.
A trend that turns drab wheelchairs, casts, and crutches into bold style statements.
Disability chic.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. AK-47s are among the most popular, most deadly weapons in the world today. It's estimated that as many as 100 million AK-47s are the weapons of choice for soldiers, including child soldiers, drug dealers, criminal gangs, insurgents, militias, and terrorist groups. Larry Kahaner says the AK-47 has shifted the balance of power in many countries, and that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times, the subject of his new book entitled AK-47, The Weapon That Changed the Face of War. Just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Before we get back to our callers, and I also want to talk about its use in the U.S. today, Larry, you say that the atomic bomb led to the AK-47 because it created proxy wars. Expand on that idea for us.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting point. I'm glad you brought this up. What happened was during the Cold War, of course, we had the United States versus the Soviet Union, and neither side really was going to start an atomic war, but two nations still had a fight over supremacy and whether communism would beat democracy. And so they found what they call proxy wars, and the first real big one was in Vietnam. And it was the United States supplying the South Vietnamese and the Soviets supplying the North Vietnamese. And what happened was you had basically the first case of the M16 versus the AK-47. And the M16 didn't work very well in the early days because of U.S. government corruption, army corruption. They did not put out the best weapon there for soldiers and used the wrong ammunition, and some say on purpose, to sort of discredit the M16, which actually came from an outside contractor, not the government's usual Springfield armory contractor. And as a result, soldiers were dying, literally trying to clean their M16s while they were being mowed down by AK-47s. And so what happened after that, when the United States lost the war in Vietnam, the AK-47 became the rifle that beat the superpower of the world. And as a result, countries all over the world looking to be anti-U.S. took up the AK-47 as their icon.
Let me get Richard from San Antonio, Texas, to join us. Richard, go ahead. Your Radio Times.
Yes, you've mentioned all the benefits of the AK-47. I'm surprised somebody hadn't come along and made the improvements on it, like make it lighter and make it more accurate. Has anybody attempted to do that, or is it at its peak, its perfect design?
Richard, I'm going to toss that to our guest, Larry Kahaner. Go ahead, Larry.
You know, that's a terrific question, because engineers talk about whether something can be made more perfect, like the pencil, as I brought up. There have been very small improvements in the AK-47 over the years. In fact, the ones that we see now, it's called AK, or mostly AKMs, which stands for AK Modified, and they use a little lighter plastics, you know, instead of wood, so forth and so on. But literally, it's basically, you know, gun aficionados will argue with me, but basically it is the same exact design as Kalashnikov had it back in the 1950s.
And the same ammunition?
Well, that's an interesting point. When the United States moved to a smaller bullet, as your other guest talked about, the Soviet Union came out with their version of the AK, which was the AK-100 series, which used a smaller weapon too, because they were trying to make some money and try to sell the AKs around the world, and, you know, sort of build their markets. They want to come out with different kind of ammunition. So those are the ones actually that you know, are out there now, and they're basically the same.
You say the AK-47 was brought back to the U.S. after the Vietnam War?
Yeah, it was brought back by soldiers, you know, who took home souvenirs and so forth, even though it was against the rules, and they took them home. And, you know, they basically hung them on their walls. I think probably used them for hunting, maybe. I'm not really sure. But that sort of introduced the United States population to the AK-47, you know, the first time it ever really came to the U.S.
And what did the U.S. government try to do to either control or ban the AK-47?
Well, there is a ban on automatic weapons, and you know that's where you just press the trigger and it just keeps firing. And so many of the AKs that the soldiers brought back, they sort of modified and turned them into what they call semi-automatic, which means you have to press the trigger each time you get a bullet. So those were kind of okay. It wasn't until the drug wars of the 1980s that you started to see AK-47s come into its full power in the U.S.
And I would assume that law enforcement in this country don't want drug dealers or gangs carrying AK-47s. What's been their response to this weapon?
Well, I think, we saw the first incident of this was what people call the North Hollywood bank robbery. Mm-hmm. And that was about 10 or 12 years ago, and where bank robbers in Los Angeles literally held police at bay, LAPD at bay, because they had AKs, and I think they even had a couple of M16s, but mainly AK-47s, and the police could not kill them, could not stop them, and it was a standoff for almost an hour until the police finally were able to shoot them in the foot. But literally, the police were so outgunned, all they had was their little semi-9mm bullets and shotguns, which really didn't help, because the men were wearing body armor, and the police had to go to a sporting goods store and literally pick up some M16s and bring them back.
And how easy is it to convert an AK-47 from semi to automatic?
It's a real interesting question, because people who want automatic weapons will tell you it's very difficult. There are other people who tell me it's very easy. I think it can be done with the right skill and the right equipment, and you can buy these kits. You know, they say not legal for entertainment only, blah, 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 that kind of stuff, but it can be done.
Let me get Lee from Center City, Philadelphia, to join us this morning on Radio Times. Hi, Lee, go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
In this entire discussion, there's been no mention of the Israeli Uzi, and I wonder what role that plays. That was particularly in the forefront in the Yugoslav Civil War, where both Kalashnikovs and Uzis were used alternately by the Serbians, the Bosnians, and by the Croats.
Ali, I'm going to toss your question to Larry Kahaner.
Well, the Uzi is what's called a it is a submachine gun, which means that it uses kind of pistol-sized bullets, 9mm bullets. And an Uzi is not the same as an AK-47, which is an assault rifle. The Israelis do have an assault rifle, which is built on the AK-47 model, which is called the Galil. And it's they started using it after the 1967 war, when they saw the Egyptians and some other Arab countries using their versions of the AK-47. They said, we've got to get this, because their M16s, which they had mainly in some Belgium rifles called the FNFALs, were clogging and from all the dust in the desert. So you've got the right country, but the wrong weapon.
Lee, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let's get Bernard from Marion to join us. Bernard, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I have a question about the ammunition.
Sure.
I mean, the AKs are so easy to make. How easy is the ammunition to make, and how difficult is it to get the ammunition to people who want to use the AKs? Wouldn't that be one way of trying to solve the problem? If you can't have the ammunition, the AK is useless, right?
What do you think, Larry?
Well, that's a very interesting point, and there are some movements that say, you know what, if we just stop the ammunition, then the guns will be useless, and it's absolutely true. The only problem is that we can't stop the ammunition. Mm. The same illegal channels that bring rifles and weapons to a country also bring the ammunition. The other thing about ammunition is that it can be handmade, and as a result, you can never really stop it, and because the AK is so forgiving of ammunition, you can put kind of junky ammunition in there and it'll still fire.
Bernard, thanks for calling into Radio Times, and we're talking about the history of the AK-47 with our guest Larry Kahaner, and his book is entitled AK-47. It's interesting that Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, wants to build an AK-47 factory in his country. What do you make of that?
Well, it's a very interesting situation, because he's buying the AK-47 for several reasons. One is because it's a way to snub his nose at the United States, because the AK is the anti-United States weapon. And the other is, there is talk, and I believe it actually, that he's going to be giving weapons to guerrillas in Colombia, FARC. You've probably heard that
sure,
that
with the Colombia drug war there, right?
Exactly, because that's what they like to use as well. I also might mention that I have a website that people will find a lot more history, more than we could go into on the show, and it's AK47book.com, kind of easy to remember. And the story about Hugo Chavez is in there as well.
Okay, fair enough. Let me get Arnold from Princeton to join us. Arnold, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
First, I'd like to congratulate you. You're spot on in your observations about the use of the Kalashnikov versus the 16 in Vietnam. I'm a combat veteran of Vietnam, and I got rid of my 16, and I used a World War II era grease gun because of the nature of the triple canopy foliage in the Central Highlands. The Kalashnikov was very effective, and the 16 wouldn't do very much. And I'm glad somebody's finally getting that story out, and I was lucky that I was able to get a hold of that 45 caliber submachine gun, which at least approximated the stopping power of the Kalashnikov in jungle warfare.
Arnold, that's a really interesting comment. It sounds like you're saying you didn't use an AK-47, but something very close to that.
The grease gun, the 45 caliber submachine gun, that was a World War II issue that some of us were able to get a hold of in Vietnam because we wanted to compete with the Kalashnikov.
And you're saying, this really underscores what Larry Kahaner was saying earlier, which was that the M16 was not an effective weapon in the Vietnam War.
No, it was not, and it's one of the ironic tragedies of that conflict. And as Ashish pointed out, is that the people who were out to make profits during the war gave us an inferior weapon, and anyone who was there knew at the time that it was an inferior weapon. And it took the scandal to try to get it right when, I guess, Colt started to manufacture it to better tolerances. And it still didn't work very well in, as I said, in jungle warfare anyway.
But it was clear that the enemy in Vietnam, the enemy of the U.S., was using the AK-47, Arnold?
Yes, and they had a much more effective weapon in the close-quarter jungle combat than the 16 was, that we were given, the highest-tech country in the world. And these local guerrillas using these mass-manufactured Chinese and Czech AK-47s had a much more effective weapon for the warfare that we were engaged in.
Arnold,
and I think it's ironic.
Well, I do, too, and I appreciate you calling into Radio Times. Larry, you want to add anything to Arnold's observations?
Well, I'm glad he's back alive.
Indeed.
I hear the story all the time from veterans, and it's really very sad. And, you know, the sad thing is that this is continuing. We send soldiers, U.S. soldiers, to fight our wars, and we don't give them the most up-to-date, the best weapon available. And this goes for Iraq now. They don't have the best rifle. They don't have the best body armor. They don't have the best helmets. They don't have the best vehicles. I mean, it goes on and on and on. And to me, it's all about the money that the contractors can make and not about what's right for our soldiers.
Well, and I'm curious because we hear, and this month so far, an enormous number of U.S. soldiers have died in Iraq. And I wonder, even when you look at the attacks on U.S. soldiers, how much from IEDs, how much from small arms fire, and how much of that do you think is an AK-47?
Well, I know the answer to that. The IEDs get a lot of drama, but literally, if you look at all of the stats, and I've actually looked at them, every single soldier that we have something on, the official word, small arms fire is overwhelmingly still killing more soldiers than IEDs. And when you look at the Iraqi population, the civilians, it's overwhelmingly small arms, and the small arm that's used is the AK-47.
Arnold, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let me get Anton from Wilmington to join us. Anton, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, ma'am. Excellent show. I'm looking forward to reading the book.
Thank you.
I just want to make a comment. I grew up in the old Soviet Union, and in the last 2 years of high school, we had to do military education, which is sort of like our OTCs. And in order to get a passing grade in it, we had to take apart and put back together the AK-47 in under a minute. And my timing was something around 45 seconds. But the question that I had for your guest is that AK-47 has an enormous recoil, and it leaves a bruise on your shoulder after shooting it for a short period of time. And I was just wondering if you could make a comment about that.
Anton, I appreciate your call to Radio Times. Larry, you want to speak to the recoil of the AK-47?
Sure. That's a great story also about I've heard the story before, and people have told me, well, they got to take this thing apart and put it back together. It's kind of like, you know, what they have to do to get a passing grade. He's absolutely right about the recoil for the 7.62 bullet. People will know what that means. But what happens with the AK-47 is that you can shoot it from your hip. And so, you know, that's not a problem. But and the recoil, the real issue with recoil is not so much that it hurts your shoulders, that it becomes inaccurate, because after the first bullet gets shot, you know, it goes all over the place. But again, it doesn't matter. You can just keep spraying and praying.
Well, and I wonder, we only have about a minute and a half before we have to say goodbye, but do you imagine then the AK-47 is here to stay?
Absolutely. It is absolutely here to stay. It's just nothing cheaper, nothing better. In fact, the Soviet Union came out with probably the world's best rifle called the Nikonov, and it's so expensive that you can't use it. But the AK is just going to be, it just keeps going on and on and on. Unfortunately for the Soviet Union doesn't even make it anymore because they can't make any profit on it because other nations make it so cheap.
And I wonder, I mean, even when you look then at countries, including the U.S., that have to take on and fight people carrying an AK-47, is there any effective weapon against the AK-47?
Well, I'm not saying that the U.S. should adopt the AK-47, but what I am saying is that the U.S. needs a real weapon that they can use in guerrilla warfare that won't overheat like the M4 does in Iraq now. And there is really nothing against it. It's really soldier against soldier. And, of course, the better-trained soldier will win.
And final question about Mr. Kalashnikov. As you said, he's invented this vodka with the name Kalashnikov. Have you tasted that to know what it tastes like?
I have. It's actually pretty good.
And it's actually pretty good. Well, Larry, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. And we've been talking with Larry Kahaner about his new book. It's titled AK-47, subtitled The Weapon That Changed the Face of War, and it's published by Wiley. He's a former Washington correspondent for Business Week magazine and covered the Infantry Training Center at Fort Benning for Knight Ridder Newspapers, and he's also the author of 8 other books. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and find out more about the program, including podcasts. We appreciate your phone calls to the show. I'm Marty Moscoane. You're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with available real-time traffic monitoring. More information at Acura.com.